Well, well, well. Two naughty, nasty little children gone. Three good, sweet little children left.
It's movie time.
What's up? What's up? Welcome back, everybody. It's the Movie Time Podcast from your Pop Zara pals. That's right. We talk about movies. We talk about things regarding movies, 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 exclamation marks all around. This is half of your co-host, Nathan Evans, back once again to talk about movies, but it's not me alone. I can't take all the credit. I'm not like that. I'm cool like that. We need our special guest host, I think his name is, Mr. Ethan Bram. Ethan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Thank me for giving you credit.
I just won't leave.
You won't leave. You try. You are the recidivism of co-hosts on podcasts. But anyway, thank you very much. So now if you're listening to this, you're going to hear things that Ethan and I don't hear because we're going to be splashing in some post-production music to not come arrears of the predatory companies that love to shut down podcasts who use their music. But Ethan, we're talking about a movie where music is crucial.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? What movie are we talking about?
We're talking today about 1971's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Wait a minute. Not the superior 2005 version?
No, don't you dare. Don't you dare.
The better version that's more faithful? It's more faithful.
Yeah. Comparing these two movies is like a case study in why a movie works better when it's a product of interpretation versus being a carbon copy. That's why Gus Van Sant's Psycho didn't work, by the way, because it tried to do it a shot-for-shot remake of Hitchcock, and it just was awful.
That's what. Yeah, but the 2019 Lion King did a shot-for-shot remake, and it made almost $2 billion.
So good. No. Yeah, no. I mean, can I start off real quick? I've recently read the Roald Dahl book for the first time since I was a kid, and it's a good book, but it's not a perfect book. Like,
not perfect. Heresy.
The movie definitely improves upon it, and the movie was, in a big part, written by Roald Dahl before he left the project.
I'll say this about the Tim Burton version. You and I can talk briefly about it, because let's just get this out of the way.
It's worth talking about, I think.
I think so, but more like a cautionary tale.
Yeah, exactly. But
it has its fans, and I think there's a reason for that. But I will say this. Let me tie this into what we talked about last time. On our last episode, we talked about two movies, one very similar to what we're talking about now. We talked about Super Mario Brothers, the movie. Then we talked about the Super Mario Brothers movie. A lot of wordplay there. We both liked both of them, but I think we both were surprised at how much we liked the maligned, castigated, you know, live action version with Bob Hoskins. Like, I think we both appreciated it, not for what it wasn't, but for what it was. It was not a good Super Mario Brothers movie at all, but it was actually a pretty good mind cluck movie, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I cannot say the same about the Tim Burton film, which I feel is ghastly, and I think it is inappropriate, and I think it's poorly made, and I think it's a... I know I'm trying to be kind, but I also think it's a poor tender to when I just stopped caring about Tim Burton as a director. I think...
Yeah, like you could say The Planet of the Apes was at 2001. That was like his first movie that like wasn't really good, but also it had some fresh ideas, kind of... It had some. It was inspired. Like, you could tell he was trying things.
It was very gorgeous, by the way. Like,
yeah, it was. Yeah, and it's not. It's nowhere near the original Planet of the Apes. No. But it's worth watching if you're an Apes fan. I think you have to watch the Tim Burton one just for. It's not canon or anything, but you have to watch it.
It's not canon.
Whereas the 2005, did you watch this recently or for in preparation for this at all or anything?
Oh yeah, like I just say this. I do not speak from which I do not know. So yeah, my vitriol my wounds are fresh.
Well, yeah, I didn't know if you just were recalling last time you saw it, but yeah, I rewatched this again. I hadn't seen it since it was in theaters in 2005, and I didn't love it then, but I was also 16 and I was, you know, not analyzing movies the way I was. And I grew up with the 71 version, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit.
Sure. But
2005, I rewatched it a couple days ago, and it's not a terrible movie per se, I think Johnny Depp gives maybe the worst performance I've ever seen by like a big name actor. He's just totally, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's confused. He doesn't know how to play the character. He's playing like at any one time, he's either Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, or Dana Carvey. And he's never Willy Wonka. You read the book and you imagine Gene Wilder. There's no way you'd imagine Ethan, Johnny Depp.
Ethan, let's just say it. Let's just get this out of the way. He's Michael Jackson.
He's so bad. And he's playing it so overtly. Like, the beauty of Gene Wilder's performance was that you were never sure if he was crazy or in demented or just totally normal. And he never lets you peek behind that curtain. Whereas Johnny Depp, they tell you, they give you backstory. They're telling you about his childhood. He's doing these weird, like, he's talking to himself.
Well, he's autistic. He's on the spectrum.
Yeah. He's definitely doing something weird. And he never makes you doubt whether or not something's wrong. And I will say the last act of the movie does something interesting. It's the only part in the entire movie that I think does something interesting, not necessarily good, but intriguing. In if you want to, something I didn't expect, I guess.
Well, in 2005, though, Johnny Depp was coming off like his greatest success of all time. You know, not just his comeback. He's always worked with Burton.
Yeah.
Let's just say this. He was always the choice for Tim Burton. But he was coming off of Pirates of the Caribbean, which reinvented him as an act. Like,
he was nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, and there's a reason why those movies were successful. There's a reason why they cannot make them without him. Let's just say that.
Johnny Depp is a great actor, but he has been miscast before. He has done movies where I'm like, I think if this weren't a Tim Burton movie, it would be cast, someone else would be here instead.
Well, it's kind of funny. It's like, you know, we talk about stereotypes. We talk about Hollywood iconography. Like, you have Marilyn Monroe being sort of the fetishization for a lot of women. Like, forget the fact that she wasn't really blonde. Forget the fact that she died of an overdose. She's considered, for some bizarre reason, like the epitome of female voluptuousness in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that, but I'm not a woman. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I really not, trust me. But the Willy Wonka character is very similar to, for a lot of like oddball actors like Crispin Glover or even, you know, like Michael Jackson or, oh goodness, what's his, like any number of people have wanted to play this role, right? Because that somehow they identify with this Willy Wonka character. And Johnny Depp, of course, was miscast. He was not appropriate for it. And I think that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. No, totally. And he has no rapport with the other characters. It's just, he's so in his own world. Like, he's such a misanthrope. Was the word I'm looking for? Like,
you said it. Misanthrope.
Yeah. Misanthrope. Yeah. And he just doesn't want to be there. I don't know if we're getting there yet, but
well, I'll tell you what. Yeah. Why don't we talk about a better movie? And
yes, please.
Then we can come back, because I think we need to revisit why the 2005 version, I think in some ways, sort of restored people's confidence in the 1971 version. Like, this happens sometimes. This happens. Like, you know, you'll see a boomerang effect where an attempt will be made. And honestly, I think we're about to see this again. I think we've seen this with the Disney live-action remakes of their animated films, where you have new directors and everything. They're not giving you new takes, so to speak. Like, Tim Burton credit. For all the faults of that film, it is not a retread of the original movie. It is not.
No, yeah.
Yeah, it is a different movie in every way imaginable.
Well, we saw it with the Mario movie, I think, and it's not even the fact that the new movie is better than the 93 one, but I think it just forces people to rewatch it for the first time in decades.
Exactly.
And so you rewatch it and you're like, wow, like this is actually holds up really well. And you watch the 1971 one, which is, by the way, over 50 years old, and you watch it and you're like, this might be, and I'm even saying, I'm even putting Star Wars in there. I'm a big Star Wars fan. This is probably, in my opinion, the best 70s movie.
I was going to talk about that. I actually put that in my notes about how this is very much a sort of, not only a 70s film, but sort of in some ways missing it by 2 years, like the penultimate 1960s film.
Yeah, totally.
Because it is a product of its time.
It's a new wave movie, yeah.
That is not a slur. A product of its time is not damning it with faint praise, so to speak.
Godfather was a part of its time, too.
Exactly. And I will say this, though. And by the way, the 2005 version is very much a product of its time, and that is a pejorative, because that was a bad time for those type of films. But I will say this, I think you and I can both say this with no uncertainty, that our love for the 1971 version and our dislike for the 2005 version is not mutually exclusive. Like, we don't dislike the 2005 version because we like the 1971 version. I think we would have disliked the 2005 version regardless. It's not a very good film, like, so to speak. It's not very... The story that it's attempting to tell is not told as effectively.
It's not clean. It's adding stuff from the book that... In a book, you can add scenes and chapters that have no connective tissue to the plot. And like in the 2005 movie, there's a whole sequence about the Indian prince and the castle made of chocolate. That is no connection to the rest of the movie, the story that he's telling. In the book, it's fine. It kind of builds up this anticipation of Wonka. Like, you don't know who Wonka is, and it's kind of showing this story ahead of time, but you don't need that in the movie. Yet Tim Burton just wanted to film the sequence for whatever reason.
Well, you know, we see this a lot. We see this quite a bit. You and I were talking about Star Wars before, and you were talking about how you liked the TV show Andor, which is a prequel to a prequel movie. So it's lots of prequels in there. But you saw this with Ron Howard's version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, where you have his version of this grotesque version of the classic Dr. Seuss tale and cartoon, which was, 22 minutes, stretched to almost 2 hours. And to do that, you have to add stuff that was not in the original tale. You have to add to it. And I don't think anything that was added benefited the film. I know it made billions of dollars, and I know the Tim Burton version was very, very successful. But I think they were successful because exactly what we're talking about, because people's nostalgia for the original film, that excitement is what led them. And the
people involved, and the curiosity too, honestly. Exactly. Like, if I never saw this movie, I'd be like, I kind of want to see it. I want to see what someone did with this story.
Exactly.
And so you buy a ticket, you know?
Well, I was going to say, final thoughts on that whole thing before we get going. There's another Willy Wonka movie coming this year.
Yeah.
This year. You know?
Some pretty good pedigree on that one, though, I will say.
I was going to say, I put that in my notes. Who is the director of that movie? It's the one...
The guy who did Paddington.
Yeah, the Paddington people.
What's his name?
I'm going to find... Paul King.
Yep, yeah.
Paul King. Paddington 1 and 2 are the best children's films made in the last 15 years. Maybe of the century. Specifically Paddington 2. I know people, you know, it's cliche to say Paddington 2 is great. Paddington 2 is great. It's a great film.
Yeah. In terms of, and you're talking in terms of literally as a kid's movie, like a movie that you can show your kid and just it's endearing and just totally affable.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think, by the way, I was looking at the credits. Hugh Grant plays an Oompa Loompa.
Please.
In Wonka.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. Yeah. I mean, I am excited. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it, and I'm going to have decently high expectations. Because I don't watch – if I love a movie and they come out with something, a follow-up, a spinoff, a sequel, prequel, whatever, it doesn't affect my love for the original. Like when they made Bill and Ted. We talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I actually get excited. I don't go into the theater in a panic. I honestly want to see what someone's going to do with it. And, you know, the new Mary Poppins, that was a piece of trash.
It was trash.
Didn't affect my love for the original Mary Poppins, and the new Bill and Ted didn't affect my love for the original two movies.
I kind of call that the Highlander effect. I don't know. Have you seen the Highlander films?
I have not seen Highlander, actually.
The first Highlander is amazing. It is a great, I think Russell Mulcahy made it. Everything about that film I love. It's one of my favorite, I would say probably top 30 favorite films of all time. It vacillates, you know, where it's at. I love it to death. Every single thing that came after that is trash. And, you know, I'm counting the TV show. So if you like the TV show, I'm glad you like it, but it's trash. And not good trash. Bad trash. Like, Take Out on Tuesday's trash. But the first movie I love. It's got a Queen soundtrack. It's got some of the best performances ever by, what's his name? Who's the actor? Oh, goodness gracious. You know, I'm going to kill my agent because I don't know this off the top of my head. So while I'm talking, I'm going to clandestinely, you know, just, you can't hear me, type in the background so I can find it. Goodness gracious. Christopher Lambert. Oh, excuse me. Christopher Lambert. So, and Sean Connery. Like, it is a movie where a Frenchman plays a Scotsman and a Welshman plays a Spaniard and an American plays a Russian. And it works. And I love it.
And there's no fights, huh?
Oh, except for all the heads getting chopped off. Yeah. It's pretty good. But, no, it was some of the best Queen music, too. But, But everything else was trash, and all the trashy sequels don't detract from how good the original was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it works.
So, yes, I'm excited about. I am honestly excited about the new one. I just think it'll be cool, and it's written by Paul King too. Everything. I don't know. I just think it'll be cool. Well, the yeah.
Yeah. So when does it come out? Do we know?
December maybe. I think it was an end of the year release, November, yeah. December 15th.
They are dead set about making Timothy Chalamet a thing, aren't they? Like, they're not going to stop until it happens, are they?
Chalamania.
Like, oh my goodness. Goodness. We'll see. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it'll happen. I mean, we need a new Leonardo DiCaprio. We need a new heartthrob. So he's all, our Leo is turning into Jack Nicholson.
As long as it's not Harry Styles.
No, that's not happening. Like that yeah. they cut their losses on that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Like they realize he has no box office appeal. Kind of like Justin Timberlake. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, good, you know, comparison. What? We're going to go in a different direction. We're going to go in the not Harry Styles direction. So yeah. That's what happens. And if you can't make it in a Marvel movie, you can't make it. So it's just how it goes. Then again, he was in the worst Marvel movie. He was in the, what was the Eternals?
Yeah.
Not good.
Well, it was the worst, but it wasn't the best.
So, 1971, the tail end of the 1960s. Let's put a little perspective on this. I said it was like the penultimate 1960s movie. If you were alive back then, I don't think either of us were. So, I wouldn't be alive for another, like, decade. And you'd be, like, alive 2 decades later, I think. So,
89, yeah.
89. Almost. Yeah, so you missed all the cool 80s stuff.
Yeah,
you were in the womb. You should have got out of there quicker, but then again, like if you live today, you're kind of reliving the '80s because they're just copying.
It's true. Everything.
Like we recycle. No, but musicals were the hot thing. Like it's hard to think of that now because musicals aren't the hot thing. But man, everything was musicals. Everything was musicals. I think Oliver had just won Best Picture.
Basically, I mean, yeah. But there was before West Side Story, and there is after West Side Story. I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Willy Wonka, I think, is at the tail end, like the gasp, like when musicals were starting to just evaporate.
Yeah.
So, but
yeah.
So where are we at though? Where are we at in 1971? So
yeah. So oh, go ahead. Yeah. Oh, you're asking me.
Oh yeah, I'm putting you on the spot.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd say okay. So it's before The Godfather. We're right in the Hollywood's new wave, which was you can say 1967 through pretty much 1980. Till 1980, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
You have a bunch of in the 60s. You have a lot of the late 60s. You have a lot of French influence, just like European influence, and so you see that in Hollywood movies. You see a lot of character driven stuff instead of Bugsy Berkeley esque type of stuff. That's a bad reference, but you know you see a lot of that kind of stuff. You see movies that are kind of experimenting. This is one of them, and in the best way possible. And then you see, and then in 1977 you have Star Wars, which changes the. You have 1975, you have Jaws. 77, you have Star Wars, which changes the game for a lot of movies going forward. I think if Willy Wonka were made after that, it would have been a different movie, and I think it would have been a worse movie. I think it's one of the best. If it's made now, it's a blockbuster. I think you have a movie that has phenomenal set pieces. What was the budget on this thing? $3 million.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was.
It's still a mid, almost an independent film.
They make phenomenal use of that budget, I will say. And it honestly comes down to the filmmaking. You have a documentary filmmaker who are famous for making really good use of their budgets.
Okay.
You have a dude who's.
Can we say this real quick? We say this. Let's plant an earworm here that we're going to revisit about the director, Mel Stewart.
Yeah.
This is a band famous for making documentaries about Nazis.
Yeah.
Makes
a movie in Germany, by the way.
Let me say this. Watching this again very closely, Ethan, there's a lot of Nazis in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I was actually shocked at how many references to Nazis are in this film. Like, there are more Nazis in Willy Wonka than there were in NASA. And that's saying something.
Yeah. Yeah, probably Augustus Gloop's whole family.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, they were
the Gloops.
I can't even talk anymore. I can't even talk. Yeah, like they were agitators. But but anyway, you're making good points. So continue.
Yeah. No. So I mean, I think it's just interesting to look at this in that context. It's infinitely marketable. You have if this were made again post Star Wars in the 80s, let's say, it would have been very toyetic. It would have been very, it would have had a lot of merchandising appeal.
It would have been toys.
You could have had toys for all the characters. Yeah. And these characters are so, it's like they're animated. I don't know how they did it with this movie, honestly. Like, every single character, every single set piece is so indelible. And like, comparing it to the new one, because I think it's good to, as an antithesis, like, nothing is memorable about the new one except for that stupid hairstyle that Willy Wonka has. That's the only thing anyone remembers.
The Dutch boy?
Yeah, it's so weird. But this movie, you have just Wonka's outfit, the purples, the set piece, the Oompa Loompas. Like, all of this was made for this movie. And there were illustrations in the original book. They don't look anything like this.
No, they don't.
And there's no color in them either. They're black.
By the way, in some cases, that's a very good thing. They don't look like the original illustrations.
Yeah, I know. They look so weird. But yeah, it's very Roald Dahl. But yeah, and you have all this, you have pure imagination, to use the pun. But it's so good, man. This movie, I think it's maybe, if you put it in its box, in its in relationship to the time period it was made, I think it's as impressive that this movie as was made as Star Wars in that time period, and as any movie in their time period. I think it's so phenomenal what they did with this movie, and it's so imaginative in a time where people weren't thinking like that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm looking at the top grossing films of 1971, the top 10 on Wikipedia, so you can follow along. I'm just going to go from number 10 to 1, and you've heard of almost every one of these. In fact, you may have heard of all of them. Number 10, Willard. Yes, sorry, the original Rat movie. Yeah. Number 9, The Last Picture Show. Number 8, Carnal Knowledge. Number 7, A Clockwork Orange. Number 6, Dirty Harry. Number 5, Diamonds Are Forever, James Bond. Number 4, Summer of 42. I've never seen
random.
It.
That's random.
Never saw it. And that's number 4? Yeah. Wow. Number 3, The French Connection. Number 2, Billy Jack. And number 1, Fiddler on the Roof. Talking about, talk about musicals. By the way, John Williams movie too. So
he did that. Okay.
He reinterpreted the music for the film.
The music, got it. Okay.
Yeah, but what a collection! It's a good year for film.
It's a great year. Yeah, you look at from again 68, I think, on. You look at, you just go to each of those fill in the blank year in film. Pretty much from 68 through, I'd say 77, 78. And every year there's like a couple dozen movies. You're like, wow, this year had so many good movies. Like, I can't believe that movie came out this year. That movie came out this year. And 71's another one of those movies. I mentioned a movie to you the other day. Play It Again, Sam, or Play Misty for Me. Misty for Me.
Yeah. And Clint Eastwood, like, let's just say this was the year of, this year of Dirty Harry, one of his biggest hits of all time.
And that too. Yeah.
And his directorial debut with Play Misty for Me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it was a big year for Clint, too. And yeah, this is a good year. This is a really good
Clint
year.
Clint Eastwood as Willy Wonka.
Ooh, yeah.
That would have been brave.
Yeah. So, I mean, and speaking of the new wave, I mean, you had Gene Wilder got his start pretty much. And Bonnie and Clyde was where people, I think, took notice of him. And that was like, that's the seminal new wave
movie.
The starting point.
Let's say this, though. Forget Bonnie and Clyde just for a second, although we can't just forget it. But, like, this is after The Producers.
Yeah.
Like, this is after The Producers, and this is right before Blazing Saddles, right? So you have the how do you say it, the Wilder Renaissance? How can we portmanteau that into a Wilder Renaissance? But you literally have Gene Wilder in quick succession doing The Producers, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And I think that alone is a career for anybody. That alone is a career for anybody. And I think, to some extent, I think Wilder he loves his role as Willy Wonka, but I secretly always imagined he almost regrets it because it would typecast him in the 80s when he tried to to distinguish himself from this, because the film was not a success for the 70s.
It was thanks to TV, modest commercial success. But it was also arguably one of the first times we did see a movie kind of get a second life on TV. I know, like, obviously Wizard of Oz is the case study for that. But yeah, this is another one you can look at and be like, wow, like, this movie did not make a lot of money upon its initial release. It was, heck, there were silent films made more than this movie. Mm-hmm.
made. Well, that, we see that a lot, though. We see that second runs give movies second life. And and I think what happens is during the 1970s, we see increasingly the importance of television, specifically cable television, network television.
Home media, too.
In the late 70s, early 80s, we have to see the, you know, just the absolute domination of VHS. Like, VHS would change everything.
I think this is one of the first movies. I think this was one. Was this one of the first? Was it like 10 that they came out with? Was it whatever the studio? A studio came out with, like, it was like the first, like, Sound of Music, Star Wars. It was like 78, 79. I can't remember if this was.
It might be. For those who don't know, VHS tapes cost a lot of money when they came out. They were like $100, $200. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in 70s money. That was like, that'd be like $300, $400 now. And that's what, you know, that's, there was lawsuits, there was Supreme Court decisions, there was all sorts of shenanigans going on where movie companies were trying to limit the reach of VHS because they thought it would destroy cinema. They did not see the synergy between VHS and
movies. The opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the exact opposite. Some people would say, Ethan, that that exists now with piracy. Like, if, and I'm not advocating piracy, but if you look at the list of top movies versus top piracy, they're parallel to each other. You know, like, people want to see your product. You have to get it in their hands and you have to make it accessible. And people will pay for things. They will pay for it. You just probably won't get that return immediately. You know?
Yeah.
Again, the 2005 Tim Burton version made a lot of money. I don't have the box office on me, but it made a fortune. And it's been largely forgotten now, which is, you know, just. So.
Yeah. And I will say, too, early home video did benefit, the theatrical movies benefited from the fact that those movies were a poorer quality, and also people were watching it in a different ratio and on worse, like, small screens, basically.
You know what's funny, though? Sometimes what's interesting about that is they did, if you actually look at the history of the movies they put on network TV, and I don't have any, like, other examples on me, I didn't research it, but you often see that you'll get different variations of the film. Like, they'll put deleted scenes in, they'll add music. Like, there are versions of film that appear on TV that you'd almost never see again because they've had to extend it out for commercial sake. And by the way, this movie itself was the product of a commercial. Like, it was funded by Quaker Oats.
Yeah, it's
like,
true.
Yeah, did you ever buy the Willy Wonka candy? Did they have it when you were a kid?
They did. Yeah, they had Gobstoppers. I think it's the nerds, I think, are Wonka, yeah.
But they had that other version of Wonka that looked more like the Disney's Mad Hatter. You know, it wasn't.
Yeah, it was more based off the book art, the art from the book. Yeah.
Speaking of that, I mentioned the artwork. I love Quentin Blake to death. He's the artist who did most of Doll stuff. Mm-hmm. But here's a little wiki thing for you. By the way, you and I pride ourselves on not just regurgitating Wikipedia facts, because I think a lot of podcasts, look, no shame in the game, but you know, y'all know who you are. But a lot of them are just people reading facts that they got on Wikipedia. That is not us. Like, if we make a mistake, it's because we genuinely messed up. So.
Yeah, we're trying. We try to go off the top of the dome too.
Exactly. Like, if the movie meant a lot to us, like, that's what we're trying to convey here. Like, we're you know, but every once in a while, I'll lay some knowledge on you. But I did not know this because we're going to get into the controversy of Roald Dahl, like, briefly, because I have some I got words to say. But the original, they were pygmies. They were African pygmies, and they were very racist, racially characterized. It was after the success of the movie that Dahl actually went back and changed his own book. That's remarkable. Like, he changed him to more match the Oompa Loompas from the film, a film that he disowned, by the way. He did not like this movie. Like it.
Erroneously, I think, and I can get into that after.
But you know what, though? That's kind of a thing we see a lot, too, with authors who hate movie versions. Yeah. Like, Stephen King hated The Shining. Alan Moore hates everything that's ever been made.
Yeah,
Alan Moore hates life. Alan Moore hates himself.
Yeah, the Roald Dahl, his main argument, so he wrote the screenplay, it got rewritten. I would say it wasn't even heavily rewritten. If you read the book, there's a lot of stuff that you can see why it's in the movie, but it's not in the book.
It's from a lot of the dialogue, a lot of the poems, and a lot of the innuendos are Dahl's prose.
Yeah,
like, they're taken from him.
He changes some stuff. I think he saw, and he's a guy who's famously went back and changed his own work. He saw stuff that he wished he had done differently. Again, I said the book is not perfect. And by the way, if you read Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, that is the more American Graffiti of the book world. It is so bad. That book is just, it's almost unreadable. I don't know if you've read that.
Oh, I've read them all. They've been talking about making versions of that, but
it'd be interesting as a movie. It's not a good book. I read it to my son after we read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and he's just disinterested. It's not a kid's book, first of all. I'm not even into it.
Well, when should we segue into Roald Dahl? Because we have to talk about Roald Dahl.
Let's do it. Let's talk about him.
Okay. I'll say this, full disclosure, Roald Dahl is my favorite author of all time.
Probably me too.
Yeah, and I don't say that kindly, like, oh, I like him above everyone else. I'm not saying that. I haven't read a Roald Dahl book in over a decade. I save that. There's something about Roald Dahl's work that I genuinely, truly love in a way that I don't genuinely, truly love with most authors. And I think Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, different movie, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is the closest we've ever come to having a cinematic version of Dahl's, what would you call it? Not style, his ethos.
His voice.
Yeah, his storytelling. Man. Yeah. And like, again, and I think when Tim Burton and his team decided to make a version, they were
his sycophantic vision.
Yeah. They were so slavishly like accurate to the pings of the story in some ways that they missed the point. And I think Dahl himself missed the point. And I think film is a different medium. And, you know, we could talk all day about how he did, like, Dahl has a very, what would you say, a erratic history with Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you read about it, like he was brought over from England to work for Disney. They wanted to option his book. Dahl has an amazing story. They're never going to make a movie about him because the modern society has deemed him off limits. Like they've tried to cancel him. It did not work. They tried to. People love him too much, but he's now considered anti-Semitic. He's considered racist. His own family,
type of thing.
Yeah, his family's apologized for him, which they did not need to do. But whatever the case is, his work endures, and I think we can touch on the controversy that happened, I think, this year. Was it this year, the Dahl controversy with the censorship and the editing?
I think so.
Was that this year or last year?
Yeah, it might have been the end of last year, but we talked about it briefly.
Yeah, revision controversy, like we can get into later. No, it was this year. Oh, goodness.
It was this year
where his publishers decided they were going to censor his books. They were going to have sensitivity readers go back and change his work. And and they passed it off as just a few words, but it was not. Like, complete passages were rewritten, words were taken out. It was an agenda to make him palatable to modern audiences. They didn't expect the blowback. Like, everybody got involved, and they relented. They're going to publish the censored versions, but they're going to continue publishing the uncensored versions. If you're a parent listening to this, and you're a parent, Ethan, so you listen too. If you buy your child a censored version of Roald Dahl books, you deserve the nursing home they're going to put you in.
Yeah, if you knowingly do it.
With no visits.
Yeah, it's definitely. And we talked about this, and I read, my son's 5, he can't really read, but he can't read at all. But I read the book to him out loud, and, you know, there are, I can see there's points in there where some parents would be like, I don't, you know, I like, Roald Dahl does call kids fat in there, which is fine, but I didn't, like, as a parent reading it to my kid, I didn't want my son hearing my voice calling a kid fat, if that makes sense. Obviously, like, he hears me struggle, and he hears me say, okay, yeah, I'm trying to lose some weight, I'm trying to eat healthier. He hears me say that. He doesn't need that to come from my mouth, me, like, calling that and me thinking, you know, him thinking about that in my voice.
What happens when the Oompa Loompas sing about kids being fat? as the child is sent down a tube.
Like I said, when we watch the movie, I don't care if he hears that because it's not me saying it, if that makes sense. So, like, for me reading it, my voice saying this fat, like bastard of a kid or whatever the words are, like, he's gross and fat and whatever. It's weird for me to say that out loud to my son. So, like, that's why for me, I made the choice to say that. When he learns to read, I don't freaking care if he reads that. Again, I don't, like, he watches it in a movie. I don't care. Like, he's gonna, he's going
to
hear that.
I'm of two minds. I understand you're in an impossible position as a parent where you don't want to imprint your voice. But I think at some point, and this is my opinion, okay? I could be wrong. I'm not, but I could be. Like, at the end of the day, though, I think if you read the review that Roger Ebert did for the 71 version, did you ever read that review?
I think I have a long time ago.
Let me quote you the first paragraph real quick. Yeah. Give me one second. I'm going to pull it up for you real quick. Because he gushed over this film. He was its biggest proponent. He was a huge supporter. Let me read you the very first paragraph, because I remember this review.
Yeah, this has Roger Ebert all over it, this movie, by the way.
Here's Roger Ebert's review of Willy Wonka, the first review, on the topic of what we're talking about. It says, kids are not stupid. They are among the sharpest, cleverest, most eagle-eyed creatures on God's earth, and very little escapes their notice. You may not have observed that your neighbor is using his snow tires in mid-July, but every four-year-old on the block has, and kids pay the same attention to detail when they go to the movies. They don't miss a thing, and they have an instinctive contempt for shoddy and shabby work. And, you know, this is the thing. When children aren't stupid, I think, again, I don't know what I would do, but I think when I watch this film, and I say to myself, I understand what it is, but if I had to expose it to a child, at some point, I realize that child is going to be offended by something. The world is an offensive place.
She can get his head cut off.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, not too many children's movies have animal decapitation and bugs. But I'll say this, or freakouts, or LSD trips, the good old days. But again, I think if the child understands the narrative that is given, then the child can make that choice. And I think, again, you're between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, I wrote a note about this myself, and I didn't know where to put it in. But I was talking about kids' movies. Like, you said you liked, like, you're really excited about the Wonka prequel because of the pedigree, because people who are doing it. Right. Let me get real quick here. Like, I've always felt that the reason kids love this movie so much, the reason it holds up, isn't necessarily because of any one thing, although Gene Wilder is a huge part of it.
Yeah.
But I think it's because the movie gets a specific tone better than any other movie supposedly made for kids, because I don't think the movie was necessarily made for kids. I think the movie has a hidden, not agenda, I think the movie has a hidden layer that I don't think people talk enough about.
Yeah.
And when you read Roald Dahl, like, I've always compared Roald Dahl to Dr. Seuss, another man who they tried to cancel for very similar reasons, because, you know, he had espoused anti-Semitic views and you know, views that he disowned later in life. But there's something about writers that can write effectively for children and for adults and use the same terminology. Like, Roald Dahl would write extensively for adults later. He would write brutal short stories that consider, like, date rape and all sorts of offensive things. And he would write everything from James Bond films to everything else. And he could also write for children. And I don't think he's different. In some way, I think Willy Wonka, the Gene Wilder character, is Roald Dahl. Willy Wonka in the movie does not talk differently to children the way he talks to adults. He talks exactly the same. I could have clipped the whole movie and we could watch the whole movie together on this podcast.
Yeah. But do a commentary.
But here's one clip when Mike TV shouts a question to him. So here's this little clip right here. Little clip. Yeah. Here we go.
How do you make them?
I'm a trifle deaf in this ear. Speak a little louder next time.
You know, he doesn't talk differently to children. He talks in the exact same tone, the exact same cadence. Nothing's different. Adults will ask him about putting liquor in the candy. Oh, you know, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. And he has freakouts in front of the children. He makes no attempt to talk down to children. He is exactly the same character to everybody and everything. And I think children, like Roger Ebert said, children recognize this, right? Children can recognize this a little bit. They can see this. And
They can. No, they totally can.
And I think when you look at this, children, you know, you look at a film like this, here's my opinion about it. Children look at this film, they look at all films, and they say to themselves, adults forget how we think. And I think Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory does not forget how children think. It thinks on their level. It understands that if you watch the opening, 40 minutes, it takes 45 minutes to get to the Chocolate Factory.
It's almost exactly half of the movie. It's almost symmetrical.
But the movie is so layered because it's, again, Mel Stewart was a documentary filmmaker. The most absurdist things you've ever seen. It is vignettes. It's like Columbo episodes in this thing.
Yeah.
It is detectives. It is Nazi propaganda. Like when they show the scene of the guy who stole the golden ticket or faked it, and they show, that's a picture of a Nazi that had escaped, like escaped culpability after Germany lost. Like it's just in there. I'll talk about the song titles later. That's actually written in the same font as Mein Kampf. I'm not joking.
Really?
Yes. Like, you know the scenes when the Oompa Loompas are singing? And at the end when Mike TV becomes a mini and they start putting the words on the screen? Like, literally, the final song is written in the exact same font as Mein Kampf. Same font. I'm not joking.
Crazy.
Or how Slugworth is basically an SS soldier.
Yeah.
But no, it's like, they get it. Like, you know, you have the four grandparents that are basically lazy, which we can get into later. You have the mother overworked. You know, you have all this stuff, and everything is so exaggerated. In this world, a candy house, you know, a candy factory is the most important thing in the universe. It makes headlines. The queen is bidding on a box of Wonka bars. That's how children think. If you told me that Toys R Us or whatever is going to give me an award, that's all we're talking about. That's it. My day's done. You remember that scene in the film when the teacher dismisses the class because they heard about the contest? That's how children react. That's not how adults react. That's how children act. Children need to be scared. They like being scared. They appreciate it. They like hearing words like fat and blubble bottom and grizz and all the words that he would make up. Grizz bottom, blipple blop, you know, like fuzz wudget, like all the stuff, all those fake phony words. They don't mean anything, but to kids, they mean everything.
Yeah.
You know, and that, by the way, and the new film, the Johnny Depp one, is completely devoid of that magic. Completely. It's just not there.
Yeah, there's no speaking to kids. It's so self-indulgent. It's a vanity project in some ways. And again, it's like, it's so pandering to the doll estate. That it's not even concerned with being entertaining, I guess.
But you see, in the bad kids movies, in movies that are kids just reject, they always show the adults don't understand. They excise the adult actions away from there. It's only kids, right? Only kids all the time. Kids don't like that stuff. Kids are bored by kids. Kids want to be adults, but they don't know how.
When I grew up, the Nickelodeon was in their golden years, and almost all the shows, the characters were teenagers or tweens. And as a kid who was not a tween or even remotely a teenager, I preferred watching that versus stuff that was, aside from like Rugrats, that was an anomaly. The animated stuff's different. Live action wise, though, you know, you want to watch people who you want to live vicariously through these characters. And if they're too much like you, then you lose that imagination and you lose that empathy for this different experience. And it's pandering to you. And you like kids shouldn't want that. And unfortunately, we can go into a whole
diatribe
about how children's television sucks.
Oh, we would be here for weeks. We would never leave.
Dahl's main problem with the movie was that he said it focused too much on Wonka, not enough on Charlie. Which, by the way, he's wrong about. And also, by the way, Tim Burton's movie is even more about Willy Wonka than this movie
it's too much about Willy Wonka.
So that doesn't even make any sense why Tim Burton would even go in that direction. Also, though, the movie is very much about Charlie. It glorifies him more than the book does. You read the book, and the book kind of forgets about Charlie a little bit, and it does focus on the kids and the factory and Wonka. Whereas the movie, I think, is out of all three iterations of it, does the best job of kind of putting Charlie on this pedestal that he's not perfect. He's the kid who plays him, Peter Ostrom.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. I think that he's one of my favorite kid actors I've ever seen. He's thoughtfully kind. He's never made to be saintly, though. He has flaws, and that's okay because he's a kid. And the one mistake he makes, he's the only kid. All the kids, including him, make the mistake in a factory. They break a rule. They do whatever. They don't listen. But his mistake was actually from temptation by his grandfather. It wasn't even him.
Well,
it was his grandfather who urged him.
I love the fact that modern thinking has rightfully made Grandpa Joe as the villain. Because Grandpa Joe is a bad influence. He's a bad influence. He's selfish.
Yeah.
And we could get into Grandpa Joe all day long.
But I don't even think he's the villain. I think he is just what happens if you forget to dream and forget to imagine. And all he's doing is he's not because he stopped doing it, it's because he maybe made excuses why he couldn't get out of bed, made excuses for whatever.
You know
and
what?
In turn lost his place.
You got four old fuddy-duddies living in the same bed. First of all, the Dutch oven that bed's got to be. Right? Oh, my goodness. If you watch it, you watch the film, there's actually like a bedpan under that bed. So those people aren't even getting out of bed.
I can't even sleep if I sleep longer than like 8 hours, my neck's killing me. I don't understand how these people just live in a bed.
Well, there's that scene in the beginning. And by the way, this movie is torturous. Like this movie is so riddled with ickiness, right? I love it. Like people do not give this movie any credit. That 45 minutes before you get to the factory establishes the world. You don't have the second half of the movie if you don't have the first.
Yep, it's so complimentary.
If they went just to the factory, this movie would be forgotten. It would be forgotten. You need the world building to show that this world is like the visage of how insane how children view this planet. And so you have these four older people. First of all, you have the poor mother who's working her butt off to not only raise Charlie. Charlie has to get a job, but four older people who don't get out of bed. I mean, what is she poisoning them to get their social security? Like, what's going on here? But the scene when Charlie comes back and he's got a loaf of bread, he's castigating Grandpa Joe for eating cabbage soup. First of all, cabbage soup, yuck. And he brings out this loaf of bread like it's like Midas is, you know, turning bread to gold. And you get the most horrible exchange in the film. He's like, here's money for your tobacco. I was like, tobacco?
Yeah.
Like, they acknowledge it, but like, you son of a bleep. Like, you're letting your family starve. You're letting this poor woman work herself to bony.
He needs it.
He needs tobacco. It. First of all, he can't get out of bed. Let it get his own damn tobacco. But later on, we show he's got candy bars. Like, he can get out of bed. He's lying.
Yeah, he's got a guy.
He's got a guy who's serving him. And that's crazy. But you know what? As soon as Charlie gets that golden ticket, he's out of bed. He's jumping around. He's singing and dancing. You know, and thank God you don't see his like wrinkled ball sack. But like he's dancing around and he's all sweet. But every step of the way, man, he's just trying to bring Charlie down. He's like, Charlie, let's drink this fizzy lifter. Hey, let's sell it to Slugworth. Let's do all this. Charlie is a better man than Grandpa Joe.
Yeah, and I think there's commentary in there too. I think there's something about Grandpa Joe. Maybe he's too disenchanted. Whereas, like Wonka said, it needs to be a kid. It can't be an adult who runs my factory. It has to be a kid. It has to be someone who, you know, won't doubt their instincts.
Run it my way, he says.
Run it my way.
Yeah, my way. Take care of my Oompa Loompas. Take care of my slaves.
But you touched on something good, like, and the new movie doesn't do. And the new movie doesn't show the Wonka mania. It doesn't show the world in shambles and unbridled chaos because of this contest. It literally shows them in the house, and it shows them watching these winners on the news. There's one scene where he goes to the candy store, and that's it. Everything else is so rushed. And the first movie, and it was totally – this is a total Mel Stewart. He probably just – came up with this idea to put these vignettes to break up these transitions between the winners, the new segments, Charlie's stuff at home.
I love it. I love the introduction of the characters. Yeah.
It's so good. And you need those random things, the machine that can guess Wonka bars. You need all this stuff. You need to see it not as just news bulletins. Like they show Veruca Salt's dad and you don't even see her on the news. You just see them kind of behind their curtain and what are they working with. And you need that stuff. The other three are shown on the news, but I think there's something important about showing the total opposite of Charlie, which is Veruca Salt.
Yes.
Who had, by the way, is like the, I don't know if this was a character archetype before this. It is the most disgusting child brat in cinema history. I don't know if, was she like the first one that was like this? Like, was there ever this archetype before?
Well,
she was awful.
You certainly wouldn't have it now, not in this day and age.
But
the character of Veruca Salt has become iconic. Like, there's a rock band named after them.
Spoiled, right? Yeah, and Dawn Cole, the actress, I think she's the highlight of the children in this movie. She's absolutely perfect. And the I Want, by the way, the I Want It Now song is besides Pure Imagination, that's my favorite song, and I think it's the unsung hero of the six songs that are in this movie. It's epic. It's got this ending with the demanding brat the whole movie. She's I want it now, I want it now, I want it now, and the very end of the song where she plummets down the garbage chute, she's it's the highest note of the song. I want it now, and she plummets, and that's how the song ends. It ends on this climax. and it's just, and you never see her again. You never see any of these characters again in the book and in the new movie. You see what happens to them.
Out of the factory. Let's not get off that because I'll get angry.
Yeah. No, I know. Because that's a mistake.
Goodness.
How brilliant was that scene though? Like with how it ends. The song is so good.
Well, there's three parts.
It's a girl singing it. It's the only time a kid sings a song. It's a solo piece. Like Charlie has a little bit at the I Want a Golden Ticket and stuff, but she's singing this song from beginning to end by herself.
You have Ruka Salt singing a showstopper.
Yeah.
Right? Oh my God. And then you have the Oompa Loompas doing their song about how if you spoil your child, it's your fault. Like literally the song blames the mother and the father. Like by name, it name drops them. And then you have the father following her, and then you have Willy Wonka topping it out with, there's going to be a lot of garbage today, like because they're going to the incinerator.
And it's not just how I think all six songs are perfect, and some of them are reprised.
I am a big fan of the music in this film, and we can get into that. But I will say this: going back to Wonka's comment about the garbage, Charlie says they won't really go to the incinerator and get burned up, and he never answers the question.
Yeah.
He never answers. He just sidesteps it, and we never
see him again. So ambiguous, yeah. It's ambiguous. Everything about him, he's ambiguous. He doesn't give you an answer. No. Yet, he makes the most sense of any character in the movie, which is awesome.
You know, I heard a lot of commentary that people do not like the music in this film. And I got to tell you, here's the thing. Segue real quick. We went to go see the new Evil Dead movie, Evil Dead Rise. And I know people on Popzara are fans of it. Like it got editor's choice from our reviewer Christian Sterling, and God bless him. I went to go see it, and immediately I knew something. Like the feeling I got when I saw the 2013 version of Evil Dead is the people making Evil Dead now. I know it's Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell making it, they're not in it. But they seem to have thought that what people wanted from the old Evil Dead movies was to jettison the comedy and make it serious. Mm-hmm. And when I look at a lot of modern kids movies, that's the same thinking. Like, no, we don't need the songs. Kids don't like the songs. Let's not put this in there. And they're starting from a negative point. They're starting from the wrong point. They've learned the wrong lessons. The people that think the songs in this movie are bad, the people that think that people don't like these songs, they're wrong. they're wrong.
Objectively, the music.
Objectively wrong. Yeah. And there's some schmaltz. And even the criticism, I agree. The songs are, the Candyman, World of Your Imagination, whatever. Those are schmaltz.
So is Rainbow Connection. So is Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Exactly. These are all classics. These are all, they're all, those three songs, by the way, this Pure Imagination, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, Rainbow Connection, those are kind of cut from the same cloth. They're saying the same thing. They're beautiful though, and they're so schmaltzy, but they're also they're not supposed
would
to
you
be
say
answers.
Would you say they're sugary?
They're not supposed to be answers. They're supposed to be a dream. It's an
yes.
Like ideals are okay as long as it's not the expectation, right? You can think, oh, it would be better like this. It would be better like this, but you can't expect it to be like that. You can't expect that to be the answer because it's not. You can work towards it. You can say, you know, the world would be better if everyone would just dream. But yeah, then you'd have then who's going to, you know, then who's going to take care of your money? Who's going to like teach you how to like finance things? Like you need other mechanical thinking people too, right? But it's definitely a song for dreamers, and it's some catharsis in there.
Well, you know what's sad on the Tim Burton version. I was really excited when I heard Danny Elfman was coming back, and he was going to be in Oingo Boingo mode. And I thought, oh, this is going to be excellent, right? But you have songs that are so inappropriate, so forgettable, so badly produced, so badly performed. Like, you literally cannot hear the lyrics.
Yeah, you can't.
You can't hear the lyrics.
It's the same lyrics from the book, but yeah, you can't
hear it. Exactly. It's, and again, a movie is a movie, a book is a book. And the book, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, very successfully transposes some of Dahl's text into the film during certain key parts, including one of the songs, like The Boat Ride, which we can get to later.
Yeah.
But the Danny Elfman version, there's something foul and unpleasant about the whole affair. And it's, there's something about it that just doesn't sit well. I don't know if you felt that way too.
There was one I liked. I liked the instrumental in one of them. I think it was like that, like tribal sounding one was kind of cool. But the rest of them were just so like.
And I like Danny Elfman, by the way, and I love Oingo Boingo. Yeah. I would be clear with you. I do love that set, but they were just not the right people.
He sounded like he was ripping off. He was doing a cover versions of his own previous work,
probably.
And there's also like some John Williams cues in there that I heard that like from specifically from Home Alone. I was like, there was like a Home Alone motif he kept coming back to, and I was like, that's very much like Home Alone. Well, but
I would say though, Danny Elfman and Tim Burton both. I mean, from that point on, though, I don't think either of them have produced anything of quality. Like that's even remotely close to what came before. Like, it's remarkable to me that the same people who made Nightmare Before Christmas, created the music for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah,
especially when you do consider John Williams, who's been doing it masterfully for how many decades now?
Still doing it. Still
more
doing
than
it.
Half a decade. More than half a century. Yes, then he's still doing it. The music is, I think the music is perfect here. I think every song, people kind of poop on the Cheer Up Charlie song. I love that song. I think it's beautiful. I think it's a great.
I got a clip.
It's probably a little maybe Oscar baity, I guess. But it's
it had to be. We had to give them on because she's a singer. I forgot the actress's name, and she doesn't really get her due. She's
taking care of the five people who don't work or who can't really work. And but I liked the music not just because of the songs were good. They were perfectly arranged. And they were perfectly directed and choreographed. And you have pure imagination, and you're just watching them run around this amazing set, picking candy. You're watching him eating the teacup, Gene Wilder. It's just everything's perfect. Again, the I Want It Now, what she's doing with like the streamers and all this, like throwing the boxes and then plummeting down the garbage chute right at the perfect time.
She's a bad egg. That's
so good. Like I just, everything's so perfect. Well, the opening scene, the Candyman. Let's talk about that. Like that was a phenomenal song. And when I was a kid, I just assumed it had already existed.
Well, you know, I had learned, and I kind of heard this before, but I deep dived into it, that Sammy Davis Jr. really wanted to be the Candyman in the film.
In the movie?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Like he really wanted to be. And of course they didn't have it because they thought he was too big a name. I think probably they couldn't afford him. He would go on to record the most famous version of the Candyman. Like one of his biggest songs is the Candyman, and it's a different take. It's different than the film version. It's good on its own, right? He's a phenomenal singer. I love Sammy Davis Jr. But you know that's the power of the song. You can call it schmaltz all you want, but it's hummable. It's clever. It's catchy. And when you hear that strange looking British man sing it, you want him to pour candy on you.
Yeah, it's so good.
All that's missing is a white van. But
it's really good though.
I was gonna say, like, do you remember the trailer for Ready Player One, the Spielberg film? Do you remember the first trailer?
Yeah, I think I do.
Yeah, it was an instrumental version of Pure Imagination.
That's right.
Yeah. And it left such a horrible taste in my mouth when I heard that. Because if you think about it, what Ready Player One was, I don't know if you saw the film or you're familiar with the material.
Yeah, I did.
It's basically saying, we're going to excise imagination from you. Like, you get to be someone else's robot. You get to be someone else's imagination. That's not imagination. That's appropriation.
And while we borrow of every IP in existence. Yeah.
Like, include... It's not as bad as Space Jam's 2, though, where they had Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
In a kid's film.
And Spielberg's a big Roald Dahl fan. He did the BFG with Mark Rylance, who is in Ready Player One as well. Plays a big role in that movie.
I did not like Spielberg's BFG.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're talking about something that's a good kids movie. Kids would be into it, I think. I haven't showed it to my kids. It's kind of forgettable, if anything. The book's so good.
It should not have been forgettable. It should have been amazing.
The book, I think, might be.
Oh, I love it. I
might
love
be my favorite Roald Dahl book is the BFG. It's one of his, when I was a kid, I loved it.
It's one of his last books. Like, it's one of his later ones that he wrote. There's a fantastic animated version of it, if you ever saw it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Was it 80s or what?
80s, yeah. I mean, the book didn't come out until, like, what, 82, 83?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Okay. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of bearing the lead here, but I did want to get into my history with Willy Wonka really briefly because it is significant.
You went to college together? You were roommates?
To my life. No. Well, okay, so if we can segue away. Okay. I did want to mention it because it is a big part of my life. I grew up with the movie. Oh, it was on TV all the time. It was one of the few I think we had on VHS. I was in a theater production when I was a kid. The first time I was ever on stage was I played Willy Wonka in a community theater. And I watched the movie over and over again, kind of like learned from Gene Wilder's cues. It was like the first time I think I'd ever really like thought about something in a granular way as far as like acting or performing or anything like that, you know, something that when you're a kid, you kind of just take for granted. Mm-hmm. But you look at it and I started looking at it as like an art form, and I don't do acting anymore. Although I met my wife in a high school production, of Guys and Dolls. But, anyway, so like Willy Wonka has been one of my favorite movies my whole life, pretty much. It's been just kind of like a constant in my life. And then came time to name my second son, and had just watched the movie, and we were like, and another one of my favorite
movies. Hold on a second. You named your son Gobstopper.
In the Slugworth.
That would be awesome. I would pay you money if you
middle name Slugworth. No. Anyway, yeah, no. So, and so we couldn't think of a boy's name. We didn't know if it was going to be a boy or a girl, cause we were, you know, like being surprised. Mm-hmm. And, we picked the name Charlie. We're like, what about Charlie? Yeah. Charlie's a great boy's name.
Yeah. It's a great name.
Great name. You don't hear it a lot in boys. There's a lot of like girls. A lot of people name their girls Charlotte, and so they can call them Charlie. But I thought it's a great boy's name. And so we went with Charlie, and my wife, you know, a few months later, my wife went into labor mm-hmm. on October 1st. And which I didn't realize at the time was the date that the movie takes place when they go to the factory is October 1st. And when she went to the hospital, I met her there. I said, let's see what's on TV right now. And I was like, nothing's on. Nothing's on. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was on TV. With the day my wife went into labor, my son was born the next day. And we named him Charlie. His middle name is Joseph, not because of Grandpa Joe, but just
you know what's
coincidence.
Funny? When one of my best friends was, his wife was pregnant with their third child. And I lobbied very hard. Sam, if you're listening to this, you remember this story. I lobbied very hard for him to name his child Charlie. And really? my pitch was, there's so many great Charlies to look up to. And I said, if you name your kid Charlie, it's not just Charlie. He gets three names, Charlie, Chuck, you know, Charles. Yeah. Like there's all these amazing nicknames you could do. And he went in a different direction. We'll say that. But, and I actually named Charlie in the Chocolate Factory as one of the key things, because you don't get made fun of. Like Charlie is a name you can't make fun of. It's really great. Hard to mock. It's a great name.
Yeah, it is really great. And I mean, I'm a Chaplin fan too. That's beside the point. But yeah, it was just so weird. And then it played in the hospital, man. Like we were literally like, what is on? Nothing is on TV. We're flipped. I was like, oh, let's see if something's on. They have the Halloween, you know, AB, what did they have over the channel, Freeform, whatever it's called now. They play their Halloween movies, and it was October 1st. I was like, oh, they have like their, let's see what's on, what movie they're playing. And it was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the 1971 version. It was just so kismet. And I was like, man, and we didn't know if we were having a boy or a girl, but I was like, I feel like we're going to have a boy. It just felt like it was fate. And then, you know, we named him Charlie.
There you go. Yeah. Kismet, they call it. So
definitely the kids are calling it that.
The kids, the cool kids anyway, the ones that recognize that Yiddish can be fun. But no, that's a great story. But you see, because the movie meant something to you, like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, we could, you and I are never going to get to the exact point, because I think what we're doing is we're trying to argue like why a flavor tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you grow a taste for it. But, you know, so if you have a daughter, are you going to name her Veruca?
Violet, yeah.
Violet. Or, so, no, but I mean, like, you know, I mean, goodness gracious. Like, we were talking about the music for a second. We were talking about imagination. Yeah. Like, and I think what this film has, and I think you and I would both agree on this one, there is something imaginative about this movie. And I think when I heard that Roald Dahl's daughter, I think, said that he would have loved the Tim Burton version, I think that's heresy. I don't think he would have liked it. I don't think he would have liked anything based on his stuff.
Yeah, he couldn't please him.
Yeah, and it's like, and like, he can't, he's dead, so he can't fight back. Like, if you're, look, Roald Dahl, if you're a ghost, come back from the dead and set your daughter straight. So set your daughter straight. But it's, but the fact of the matter is, you know, I was talking about what, why kids like certain things. And, you know, you were talking about how, you know, you have to vacillate between that line of reading the text that's not yours and trying to soften that. So your child doesn't, you know, I don't know what the right word would be, Ethan. He doesn't approximate you as saying that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's a tough road to road. I think
it is tough. It's really tough. And especially, you know, I'm not perfect. And I say things sometimes like, man, I shouldn't have said that in front of him.
Well, that's the thing. You know, that's why we have uncles for. Like, uncles can be that guy. Uncles can say the fun stuff.
Yeah.
And exactly. They don't care. Like if I came there and was like, oh, Uncle Nate is saying this kind of stuff. And
see, like, if you read, that's what I was, exactly. Like, if you had read the book to him, or like someone would had else had read it, I wouldn't have even.
Exactly.
Like, I wouldn't have cared. But it was just weird me saying it, because, you know, when you're a boy, especially, you look up to your dad in a certain way, and like everything, you hang on to I hung on to every word my dad said. And like, you know, you're a superhero to your son. Boys and their fathers, they have a very unique relationship, you know, for better or worse, and it's different. It's one of the most unique. It's why it's returned to in cinema so often. People are obsessed with the relationship with their dad and trying to rectify it or whatever. But
well, it's, yeah, you know, if you go back and read some of the revisions they were talking about, and they're quote unquote fixing Roald Dahl, it goes way beyond content, right? It goes way beyond that. It's because you see that deep down between all of these sensitivity readers, the idea is the idea of, you know, equity, equality. And I'm not going to get into politics here, right? But the idea is that, well, my sensitivity level is here. You can't see my hand, but it's like a 2 out of 10. So that's going to be my plateau. So I think that everyone should have my plateau, because I don't want to risk offending somebody. Like, well, what about a 3? Well, no, you're going to offend somebody. So let's just keep it here. We don't want to risk offending anybody, because at the end of the day, I didn't write this text. I didn't put the blood, sweat, and tears into this book. I have no real stake in this, but I want to help the bookseller sell more books. And so to do that, I can't offend anybody. And I got to tell you something. I don't agree with any of that. I think it's the exact opposite. I think you should offend everybody. Because the problem is, and hold on, let me say my piece. It sounds crazy. Offend everybody. But no, but the truth of the matter is, you don't know what's going to be offensive. So
yeah.
I think censoring words is offensive. I think that's the ultimate offense. Like, I think the ultimate offense, like, and if you go back and I'll send you a link. I don't really want to dignify any of these things with, you know, speaking them out loud. But like, some of the, like, they would change the name of words, because the word, like, I'll give you one example. The word darkly could be offensive. The word red, the word white, you know, the word red, you know, anything could be offensive. Anything could be offensive. And I think the problem is that children want to be offended. They want to be scared.
They do.
Kids are nasty little things.
That feels taboo, but it's not, right? Like, when I was a kid, I loved the Mother Goose Rockin' Rhyme. You ever seen Mother Goose Rockin' Rhyme?
Oh, yeah.
It's so weird. And so and it was creepy, but I couldn't stop watching it. I probably watched that movie more than anything as a kid. And because I wanted to be close to fear, but not totally, you know, I didn't want to watch Evil Dead or something.
I watch Evil Dead.
So, you know, as a kid, I love Evil Dead now, but it's great. But no, yeah, as a kid, did not want to watch it. Yeah, exactly. No, I agree with you. I agree with you in the sense that, like, it's all about, like, people are like I've talked to people and someone said, that's offensive. I'm like, who's around here that's going to get offended by what I just said? You're offended by what I just said? Like, you know what I mean? Like, this has nothing to do with you. Why would you be offended? Like, it's It's just so bizarre.
I mean,
to think that somebody it's all context, right? Like, who are you saying it to, in what context? Whose voice was originally saying? Whose voice is saying it now? Who's in the room? Like, you know, everyone's been offended at some point in their life, but you got to think about if someone who I don't know says something like negative about white people or something. I don't know that. I can only care so much about what that person says, who's not anybody, who's not going to make an influence on anybody's way of thinking. I can only be so offended. But on the other hand, if my, say, father-in-law said it or something like that, you know, it might be more offensive
to me. We don't teach context anymore. We just teach superficial, surface level things. And
we don't teach meaning either, like true essence of speech. There's a meaning of what someone's saying, and there's the surface level of what's the words that people are using. And they're two different things.
Well, you know, you have people who go to sensitivity class, or you have people who are trained in sensitivity.
Oh,
and,
gosh, yeah.
And I get it. People are, college graduates, these people by the buckets. And they think, well, I've got a degree in this. I understand child psychology. And for all your talents, people have not been able to reproduce the same success level as a Roald Dahl or a Dr. Seuss. Yeah. And what happens is you take these things that have been very successful and you have to, God, what's the word they used? There's a word that just sounds awful. It's goodness gracious. Let me get you that word real quick. Because every time I hear this word, I feel a little nauseous.
Schnozberry.
Whoever heard of a schnozberry? Like, but let me see real quick. Let me give you this word. Give me 1 second.
Jesus, a whole Wikipedia article.
Oh, yeah. Oh, ton. These are all can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't see it on the podcast, but I'm scrolling past some of the changes they made.
My goodness.
Yeah. It's not good. What is the word I am looking for? It starts with an E.
It was in the book or the movie?
Expurge. That's the word. Expurge. Like, expurge. It's not enough to censor. You must expurge that word. And I was going to make a segue about how they're very similar. They're doing something to Ian Fleming, you know, the James Bond creator.
Yeah. And R.L. Stein. What did R.L. Stein?
He was against it. He, like, no one told him. He was upset about it. But
what are they taking out of his book? He was not, he didn't say anything that was even remotely like, Roald Dahl, I can see people taking offense to some of the stuff, but.
Like some of this, know. Some of the stuff is insidious. It has nothing to do about that. By the way, Ian Fleming and Roald Dahl were good friends. They had a very interesting interlocked career. They actually wrote for each other. Like I told you, Roald Dahl wrote a James Bond movie.
You Only Live Twice?
Yeah. Was it that? So. Yeah, it's crazy. Like it's interesting. But he said, you know, Dahl would sour to Hollywood, of course, over the years. I think his natural view was cynicism. And if you read more about Dahl's personal life, and there's a great biography, I forget the name of, it's not a new one, it's about 10 years old, I think. Read a good, big, fat biography on Dahl, and I think you'll gain a new respect for him, even while not trying to minimize some of his stickier, like, beliefs. Like, he clearly he was anti-Semitic in a way that's probably not admirable, but you can't define a person necessarily by one belief system. You can't do that. You just can't do that. It's not intelligent. But going back to what I was saying, though, going back real quick, about children and about this and that. So, like I said, children can recognize phoniness, but they want stuff that's on their level that wants to invite them in. And I think when you dumb things down, there's no way to say it. Some of the stuff is really pedantic, and it's just patronizing to children. And they don't want it. They reject it because they can tell when they're being pandered to. They can tell when things just aren't adding up. You know, it was really hard, Ethan, to clip this movie because I wanted to clip the whole movie. I just wanted to play the whole movie on the podcast. But I think I have one clip that actually demonstrates what I was talking about. Do you remember this teacher played by the English comedian Dave Batley, who looks
he's great.
Who looks British? Can I say that? Like, if you if you had AI design a British looking man, including his teeth,
he reminds me of the neighbor in the Jeffersons.
He does. You're not the first one to say that.
Like, always reminded me of him.
Yeah, exactly. The British neighbor of all things.
Yeah.
But I only remember him from the movie Krull. Like, I hate to say it. Like, I've seen him in other things, but like the only thing I really remember him is him, and he played the wacky wizard in Krull, a movie that does not hold up as well as people think it does, but it's still pretty fun. Yeah. Liam Neeson's in it. But I got a clip from him as a teacher, and I just love this clip because as a kid, this is why I love this movie so much. Like little things like this, like non-Wilder stuff. This is the, to put in perspective, this is the scene when he's calling Charlie up to help him with an experiment. And here we go. See if you can guess why I like this so much.
Charlie Bucket.
Yes, Mr. Turkentine.
I shall need an assistant. Come and give me a hand. We have here nitric acid, glycerine, and a special mixture of my own. Together, it's horrible, dangerous stuff blows you up. But mixed together in the right way, as only I know how, what do you think it makes?
I don't know, sir.
Of course you don't know. You don't know because only I know. If you knew and I didn't know, then you'd be teaching me instead of me teaching you. And for a student to teach his teacher, it's presumptuous and rude. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, mixed together in the right way, these three highly dangerous ingredients make the finest wart remover in the world. The trick is to pour them in equal amounts. Now, Charlie, you take the nitric acid and the glycerine, and I'll take my own special mixture. You ready? Good lad, pour.
There we go. I don't know why, but I the teacher says horrible, dangerous stuff blows you up. Just says it like as an offhand. Like a boom.
So good. And it's very like a Monty Python-esque.
Oh, yeah. It very much. Yeah. And but gee, it's just the lyrics, right? The lyrics of his speech. He's like, you know, horrible, dangerous stuff blow you up. Just offhand, just blow you up. You know, here you go, 10-year-old boy. Here's some dangerous chemicals without any protective gear. Now let's go explode something. And just that's how kids see it. That's what kids want. Yeah. They don't want to wear protective goggles. They don't want that. And
it's just the world building. That it's not even in relation. Like, see, that's not even directly related to the plot, but it sets up his relationship with his teacher, and then which serves like another scene. And it's just really, really funny.
The scene when he's trying to teach Charlie in the class math, but he can't divide by two because it's too small a number.
Two? Yeah.
Well, I heard of only two. You know, just I'm gonna poverty shame you. Only two candy bars.
Yeah. That reminds me, do you think, and they touched upon it in the new one, which which made me upset because I always thought it was like a fun theory that I thought of, and I'm prideful like that. But do you think that Wonka handpicked the winners, or do you think he just studied them as victims?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I mean, again, I told you there's a whole subversive movie going on underneath the one. Like, and I think if you examine it, it's like you get presents on Christmas because Santa gave them to you. When you're 8 years old, that makes sense. But if you start questioning it, then you realize there's no Santa. Yeah. Sorry, spoilers, if you're over eight. But like, and I think that's what this movie is. I think you always see Slugworth. Slugworth is always there when the golden ticket is found. Always. Yeah. Like, you know, he obviously...
Across the Europe, yeah.
Yeah, or there's that scene when they're going into the ferry. And they're going into the famous boat ride. And there's only enough seats for children if Augustus and his mother's gone. Like, it's all planned. I mean,
didn't think about that. Wow.
Yeah, because Willy Wonka's a psychopath. And psychopaths can plan multiple levels.
My thing was that at least Charlie was picked. I think the Candyman, so we see the Candyman, the candy shop is right like a block away from Wonka's factory, right? And the winning bar was actually not picked by Charlie, but by the shop owner.
Exactly.
So my theory was always that he was in cahoots with Wonka, and you know, they're in the same town. It's just like, what are the coincidences that
or
boy lives in Wonka's town is one of the winners.
Well, you know, that scary scene when Charlie is walking at lone, you know, God bless the 70s when a 10-year-old boy could have a job, you know, and just walk home at night alone at 11 p.m.
Yeah.
Right. But he's approached by this scary old man who's giving him this terse, like, you know, he's quoting this famous poem about the fear of little men as he's, you know, as his little cart full of sharp knives is clanking away. You know? Like, that's not creepy.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's...
Well, and then when Wonka meets Charlie, he's like objectively more ambivalent than when he meets the other four kids. Like, he's like, oh, Mike TV, nice to meet you, whatever. And then it's Augustus. And then it's like Charlie, ah, yes, very good. Okay, walk in. And then it's just definitely you can kind of tell he's kind of laying these tests down to see like if his purity will hold up along the way.
I'll go one step further. It's basically Seven for children. Because if you think about it, the movie Seven, it's a serial killer who does the seven deadly sins. Well, Wonka is basically picking these victims out because they're selfish and they need, you know, they need punishment.
Gluttony, pride,
Yeah, the Oompa Loompas have rehearsed songs that are particular to those children. That's not random. That choreography takes time. Writing those lyrics takes time. They had this stuff planned. He's a psycho.
Yeah, and the fact that they point that out in the new one too, I'm like, come on. Like, even if, like, just let things be mysterious.
By the way, I'm joking. Like, obviously, you know, this is a children's movie. This is a movie that's a fantasy. Like, if you try to explain everything, it's like the famous quip, you know, explaining a joke is like dissecting a frog. You know, the joke's not funny and it upsets the frog. Like, there's no reason for anything. It is what it is. It's magic. And I will say this. Go back to the original movie for a second. There's one scene more than anything that pisses me off about the new version. One scene, and I can't show it to you. It's a podcast, but it's this. It's the pivotal moment when Charlie finds the golden ticket. If you watch the new version, Charlie gets the ticket. He opens the thing, and it's right there. The ticket's right there standing out. There's no buildup. He just opens it. It's boom. It's right in front of his face. If you watch the original version, when Charlie gets the chocolate bar, it's slow. The music slowly trebles. He opens the candy, and there's no golden ticket, but then he reaches down further, and you can see the shock on his face, like, huh? And the music's triumphant.
Oh, the music's so good right there. Oh, jeez.
Like,
it's so good.
That's the scene. That's every child. Like, that's it. You found the golden ticket, and that movie the old film captures it more perfectly than any movie has ever captured any childhood moment of all time.
And there's a scene right around that part, right? In fact, right in that part, that essentially sums up the entire movie, I think. And if there was a theme to this film, I think it's this, is that we just witnessed this, again, unbridled Wonka mania. And at the beginning of the movie, we see a crowded candy shop. And this is before the contest was even announced. This is crowded candy shop, and there's no contest yet.
Exactly.
And then we see Wonka mania, and then all of a sudden, you know, the world, Mel Stewart makes a point of showing the streets lined with chocolate bars that are uneaten, just ripped up open enough to see if there's a golden ticket. People have forgotten the joy, the simple joy of chocolate. And then when Charlie goes into the chocolate shop at the end, he thinks the contest is over.
Yeah.
And we see the contest is over, and juxtaposed with the beginning of the film when the shop was packed before the contest. Now that the contest is over,
exactly,
also no contest, it's completely empty except for Charlie, who finds money on the street and just wants to enjoy the luxury of chocolate with no strings attached, no pressure, and he buys two bars, one for him, one for his grandpa. There's no contest in his mind. And it just sums up what this movie is, in that it's just...
You forgot one thing, though. You forgot one part. At the beginning, when all those children are enjoying chocolate and the candy man is sprinkling his candy wares around, Charlie's looking in forlorn from the window. He's not able to join them because he has to work.
And now he's on the inside, and there's no other child in there because the contest is over. People have forgotten the joy, the simple joy of chocolate. You eat chocolate. You eat it, and then it passes. There's no nothing lingers, but it's so, I don't know if you're a chocolate fan. I'm a big chocolate guy. I grew up down the street from the Ghirardelli factory. I'd smell it every morning.
When I was a child, it's every child's dream to live with chocolate. Now, as an adult, all I see is cavities, like in diabetes.
Yeah. It's definitely a delicacy as you become an adult. Like, okay, I'll have like one piece today or something. I love dark chocolate.
Charlie's salvation comes from the trash, because he's the trash.
Yeah.
He has to look in the sewer, the gutter, right? And that's when he finds the money, because he looked down in the trash, because his mother told him not to have dreams. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
She sings the whole song, Cheer Up Charlie. But do you remember the advice she gives Charlie about not living in the clouds?
Yeah.
I have that clip. Let me play that clip.
Do it.
Because
let's do it.
This is the mom. This is why he didn't pick the mom to go to the factory with him. Because mom's a downer.
Screw you, mom.
Here we go. Here's the advice. Here it is.
Charlie, there are 100 billion people in this world, and only 5 of them will find golden tickets. Even if you had a sack full of money, you probably wouldn't find one. And after this contest is over, you'll be no different from the billions of others who didn't find one.
But I am different. I want it more than any of them.
Charlie, you'll get your chance. One day things will change.
When? When will they change?
Probably when you least expect it.
Yeah, thanks, Mom. That advice means nothing. Like, don't try. Don't achieve your dreams. Don't have dreams. Be like me. Wash other people's drawers. Like, taking care of 4 old people and a dependence.
doing like ambiguous tasks that no one knows what I'm doing. I'm stirring laundry. But there is value to what she's saying to a point, like, right? Like you have to be realistic, but exactly. You also have to be able, you have to keep your feet on the ground while you're dreaming. Otherwise, you know, you'll have no backup plan. Because if you put all your eggs in one basket and you succeed, you're a genius, right? Well, if you put all your eggs in one basket and you fail, you're an idiot.
Well, just so remember though, like, but she's also saying in the context, the fact that they're living in abject poverty and starving.
Exactly.
And she's having to stir laundry and eating cabbage while spending useless money on tobacco.
It makes sense that we can't afford the chocolate. It's like, right, if you're in poverty, you're not buying, you shouldn't be paying for lottery tickets, right? Saying, oh, I might win the lottery. It's like, you need that couple bucks a day or whatever, however much you're spending on lottery. You need that for other things. Like, you shouldn't be playing the lottery. It's a fool's game. It's a loser's game, right?
Oh, yeah.
But you win and it's like, oh, man, I like, you know, you're a genius. But it's worthy advice to take, but you have to filter
and then,
it. You have to,
and then the mom disappears from the movie. Like, after the
literally,
bad advice. That's
the
after
last.
The bad advice, you're like, mom, you don't help this plot move forward. You sing your song. You said your piece. Now, Grandpa Joe, you know, who you've supported through his negligence, is going to get his ass out of bed and start dancing the jig and accompany me and then get me in trouble at the chocolate factory because I'm a child. I make mistakes.
And I don't know if there's an alternate ending to this movie. I didn't read into it, but I love the ending, how he's just flying over the town and the music's playing. And it's like, you know, you don't need to see him get the factory. You don't need to see him like landing in the house or whatever.
No. We could talk about that in a second. But I was going to say, you get the impression that Willy Wonka didn't even know if his elevator was going to work. Like, it smashes through that glass building. Like, he was ready to die. Like, this was his suicide pact. Like, he was going to give his factory to a child and just check out. You know, that's his end. Like, and there's no easy way to say this. And I look, if you have suicidal tendencies, call the number. But I'll say this. We talk about Gene Wilder's performance, but what we haven't talked about is his psychotic attitude. Like, this is a man who he has a freak out on the boat. He literally, like, shows images of animals being tortured and creepy crawlies. And he has psychedelic pictures in the background.
Children, everything in his office is half there, half not.
It's half there, half that. He screams at people. He yells at people. He jokes about children being incinerated and exploded. You know, he basically hints that he, like, colonized an entire island and transported its entire human population to work for free.
So nonchalant. He's just so nonchalant about everything. And then was it when Augustus Gloop is drinking? He says, no, please don't stop.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, like, stop. Come back.
No, please. Come on. But then in the next scene, he's like, we had to, like, no human, or right before, he says, human hands can't touch it. Like, he's excited. Like, he's passionate about it, but then he kind of still wants to see this kid fall in the river.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. I think it's one of the most perfect movies ever made. And I think it's just, again, you can't plan this. You can't be Tim Burton. You can't fine tune every aspect of it. What you do is you make a plan. And if it works, the things that work are going to work. And a lot of times you get happenstance works in your benefit. And like, the new movie I'm watching, and there's all these close-ups, and you know, when a character's talking, it's just on their face, and then another character responds, and it's just on their face. The 1971 movie is filmed almost like a stage play at times. Like, you're watching the whole set, and so it gives room for the actors to react to things, to react to other characters, to react to the world around them, to pipe in off-screen. A lot of times people are responding to Wonka off screen. You don't even see them. You just hear their voice. You know who it is, though.
Exactly.
And it's so good, and it's organic, and there's nothing, when you do a lot of like close-ups and shot reverse shots or whatever, you lose that spontaneity.
There's no intimacy in the new version between you as a viewer and the film. Like, for example, I talked to you about the moment that Charlie finds the ticket, how it's just masterful in the original.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's masterful. The opening, too. The opening is, you have that nice, gentle music. You have chocolate being developed. It's the same opening in the remake. It's chocolate being developed, but it's cold, sterile. It's CGI. It's CGI. It's all automated. It's there's the camera doesn't linger because there is no camera, and it's a factory driven machine like the movie itself. It's a piece of product, and the and I think more than anything else, it's the introduction of Willy Wonka that really separates the two. I mean, you have the most iconic scene in the film, which is Willy Wonka introducing himself. It's quiet. It's hushed. He's walking. He's limping. Then you almost don't notice that he sticks his cane and it sticks in the ground, and then he does this, he falls, does a somersault, and you know the famous story, which everyone knows now, is that that was his prerequisite for joining the film.
He wanted to do that. He wanted because from that point on, you didn't know if he was lying or if he was telling the truth.
Exactly,
and you needed that. And whereas in the movie is salvageable, the new one is salvageable up until. Johnny Depp arrives. I think it falls apart terribly.
But you see him well before, though. You see him way before.
You see the flashbacks and stuff.
You know,
but when he becomes a character in the movie as a present day character, the movie I think falls apart. And I think before that you can do something with what's there, but I think after that it's just disjointed and a mess.
Well, the arrival of Wonka, the introduction of Wonka to the kids, is unpleasant. It's unpleasant. Mm-hmm. It's loud. It's noisy. There's no feeling of awe. There's no sense of wonder. And I think part of the imagination, I forget who said it, but someone said, when you have imagination, you can't just introduce. You have to allow it to digest. You have to say, here's this moment. Like other people better than me have compared Willy Wonka to The Wizard of Oz. And I think that's appropriate because you have very similar introductory scenes, not because... Oh, this is a film. We need to fill up time. But you have lingering shots on what matters, like little things, like ruby red slippers, transition from black and white. You know, you look at the yellow brick road. It's like, well, where does the other road go? Like, you know, you have moments like that. I mean, yes, it's all on a soundstage, and yes, if you look closely, but that's in some ways. I said this at the very beginning that this movie's dated. I don't know if you agree with me. Yes, it's a low budget, relatively low budget 1970s movie. Yes, the candy looks like plastic. Yes, the chocolate river looks like sewage. It does. It looks like
one part. Yeah.
It looks like a sewage. Like you don't want to be tasting that. It looks like it has diphtheria or something.
Yeah, and I think that was like a problem. Like he was upset with how that turned out too.
Yeah, I mean it does, but you know, and you know, the props look like props. Right?
Yeah.
You get it. It does. But and if you look carefully, you can see the seams. But that's okay. The children don't see the seams. It's like one of my favorite things in the universe, one of my favorite things on the planet is this video of, I think it's Jim Henson doing Kermit the Frog. And I think what happens is he's talking to this little girl and he is such an expert. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I know the video, yeah.
Yeah. And Jim Henson is such a master of his craft, he's able to convince the little girl that Kermit's real. And she's making eye contact with the puppet. And she wants to kiss her. She wants to kiss Kermit. She loves Kermit. And Kermit will look at the screen and start, you know, breaking the fourth wall. Like, and he's doing this in front of her. And she believes that Kermit's real, right? Anybody can tell it's felt. Anybody can tell it's golf balls. And everybody can tell there's a human being with his hand up the frog's butt. It doesn't matter. Kids don't, it doesn't matter. That stuff only matters to adults. It only, because kids don't rationalize it like that. Kids don't say, oh, I can see the chocolate water looks like poop. You know, I can see that he, you know, he's biting into a wax figure. Kids don't care about that stuff. As long as you got the, feeling, as long as you got the intent right, kids forgive anything. Like, why do you think we like cartoons? Cartoons don't look real. You know?
Yeah.
They don't look real. The intent is there. Like kids are smarter than adults, like Roger Ebert said. They're much more forgiving because they know it's important. It's not important to be, you know, to have fidelity to photorealism and to have stuff like that. And, you know, we talked about the remake. The most offensive scene in the remake, I think you'd agree with me, is the scene when they show the children, like at the aftermath. Like when, you know, like, oh, they're still alive. We need that for the audience. We need to show that the kids are still alive. They haven't been incinerated.
But it was in the book, Nathan.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I know.
It's like the Bible for Tim Burton.
Yeah, it works differently though, because when you're reading a story to something, it's a different animal. Exactly. you know, like, you know, Douglas Adams, the guy that created Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know this. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy did not start as a book. It started as a radio drama. It started on the radio. And he adapted it into the book. And when he adapted it, he changed things. He changed it to fit the medium. And then he adapted it again when it was a television series. Then he adapted it again when it was a video game. Yeah. So you have different versions of it.
Well, why do you think early television is so crude? It's because it's trying to be radio.
Exactly.
When it becomes television in the 50s, when you have I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners who change the medium, then that's when people can really start working with the medium.
There's a good word for that.
Before that, it's bad. It's really not good. I mean, you have like, yeah, you have Burns and Allis or whatever. Or Burns and Allen, and you have like a couple of early stuff, but other than that, like, it's not good TV. It's very, very crude and it's dated, and some of it's good and most of it's bad.
Well, exactly. And you know, like I said, when you have like theater, for example, you have theater and you have a medium which requires you to be on a stage, and this is before, you know, before projection, before like, you know, microphones and everything. So you need a good acoustics. And you needed to be able to project your voice and your mannerisms to the people in the back seats. So you had to create a new style of acting. You couldn't be you couldn't be Sean Penn. You couldn't be Marlon Brando and mumble. You couldn't do that. No one could hear you.
Yeah.
So you had to be cartoonish. You know, you had to be charismatic in a way that maybe you wouldn't want to be. But if you put that on a movie, it looks silly. The theatricality does not lend itself to good drama like that.
That's why by like the second decade of the talkie, you have actors like Brando who are starting, and James Dean who are starting to realize that you don't need to be over emote. You can just kind of be nuanced and
exactly.
But it took a couple decades. It took before people started doing that kind of stuff. Because there is this transition when the medium evolves to something so drastically, like the addition of being able to talk or like from radio to TV or whatever. There's going to be some kinks to work out. They're not meant to be the same thing. Books are not meant to be film. There are so many books that are amazing, and none of them should be exactly adapted to the screen how they are written. They just shouldn't. You're not writing a book thinking this is, I mean, maybe now you are, but you shouldn't be writing a book thinking this will look great on screen. You're writing it. Otherwise, you lose your freedom as a writer also.
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure because I think publishing has basically become a prequel for television and movies.
Exactly. I know. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Now you make deals, and before you've even written their first word. Yeah,
exactly. Like it's a much more like we won't segue into that. It's very depressing if you want to talk about publishing. But Roald Dahl was a man who, again, was an accidental writer. You know, he was from the RAF. You know, he wrote a book. He wrote a story called Gremlins. Disney wanted to buy it. He came to America. He got disgruntled by the process, and he got snookered into it by writing movie scripts. Like, that's actually how he started. Like, he didn't start writing children's books. The children's books came after that. And part of that cynicism was his experiences in Hollywood. And he had a knack for it. And like I said, it's a wonderful story that I encourage anybody to read his process. But he was also a very deeply unhappy man with an unhappy life. And I think writing for children, writing that specific process of being able to create words and create languages that don't necessarily translate, right? That's okay. It's okay that his words are better read. You know, you find a movie like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, you have someone like Gene Wilder, and they interpret them. It's very Shakespearean in a way, like that you're able to take this character and make it so unique off the page.
Yeah, well, and also you have in the new movie, you have a character who's, you know, Willy Wonka, and they show him, you know, going into these modes where he's like thinking to himself and like, oh, yes, parents, fathers. And then he goes into a flashback, whereas the original movie, you don't need that. You can have it just be the scene at the end. Like, this character has pain and he has you know, he laments thing, he's disillusioned, but he's not showing that throughout the movie per se. You just see him at the end in his office, his head's in his hand, and he just kind of like, wow, this guy has sadness to him. That's all you need. You just need that last scene. You don't need it throughout the whole movie. And by the way, he's not, when you see Johnny Depp doing this thing, he's not doing it like, he's not presenting this magical world for these kids. Whereas in Gene Wilder's iteration, he's saying, look, I'm going to make this, show you the most marvelous thing in the world. And if you choose to buy
to it, then it's like he's tempting them. He's like, you can have this, but we're going to have, you know, the golden eggs. We're going to have the chocolate river. We're going to have the TV room. And he's tempting these kids. Instead, the new movie, it kind of plays it off as like, I don't really care. I'm not happy here. Like, I don't want this to, like, if you want this, sure, take it. Like, you know, there's no presentation of that dream. Like Gene Wilder is presenting this as, this could be yours if you want it. This is a marvelous place to be. Do you want to be here? Do you not want to be here? And these kids just choose not to be there. Whereas in the new movie, it's like, why would these kids want to have this factory? Like, this seems like an awful place. Why would Veruca Salt not? She's never been presented with the opportunity to change and to be like, this is what you can have if you follow the rules.
Exactly.
So why would she want that?
Exactly. Like, because they're not really characters. They're in service to the page. Like, they are versions of they are Tim Burton's version of the words that he read on the page, and this is his interpretation of them, as opposed to his interpretation of the story and how these characters could be serviced better in the film. And I think I think there's an artificiality that I think is very, very apparent. And I don't think that artificiality, despite all its flaws, and the 70 version is very flawed, despite its flaws, is mm-hmm. authentic. And I think that's the reason why it resonates so well. And by the way, I think the success of the Tim Burton version is because of the resonance of the original film. You know, I think, yeah. and I, again, that happens quite a bit. And I don't really know where else we go from there. I think just watch the film itself. It's around. You can find it. It's easy to get. You probably have already seen it. If you haven't seen it, why? Why haven't you seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? What are you holding out for? What are you waiting for?
It's on cable.
Christmas?
It's on network TV.
But I will say this, though. Here's my final thought about the whole thing. I could talk about this all day. We do live in a strange age. We live in a weird age that is unique to both me and you, where Hollywood is more likely to renew something. It is to make new versions, to update things, because they want to make it for modern audiences, you know, modern sensibilities mm-hmm. and all this. And the last Willy Wonka was, what? Ooh, my goodness. Has it really been 18 years? That's crazy.
Yes, and that's almost been 2 decades.
And we're getting a new Willy Wonka, and maybe it'll be successful. Maybe we'll have prequels and sequels after that. You know, I mean, they made a Tom and Jerry version a couple of years ago. That's crazy. But that was different. Yeah. That was a very cynical exercise. Although the same man who made the music from the live action one returned to make music from the Tom and Jerry version. Go figure. But yeah, it's crazy. But I was going to say, though, it's just, and I don't know if you'd agree with me, but here's my final thought. It's not saying that this will always be the definitive version and Gene Wilder will always be the definitive Willy Wonka. It's just that it's magic in a bottle that happened in 1971, that so many good things came together at this one moment, at this one time, to make this imperfect 1971 movie that found an audience, continues to find audiences, and continues to delight people. And maybe that will happen again. I hope so. Like, I think every generation deserves to have its own stuff. But I don't think every generation needs to have other nostalgia slopped on it. So I would hope that if you do find this movie, if you've never seen it, or you're going to introduce your children, don't introduce it as though something they will love as much as you. They might, and they might not. But I think forcing it on them, forcing yesterday's nostalgia, I don't think it's appropriate. Like anything, or like changing the words of a writer that you didn't write. Like there are ways to handle mm-hmm. it. And I think this is a very good litmus test, both from film and a book perspective. I think it opens up a lot of maturity for children, I think, to accept life's limitations. And the fact that sometimes you live in a slum and you gotta work and you gotta eat cabbage soup because life is, you know, crapped on you.
Yeah.
But a chocolate factory waits.
And it's the perfect example of, I think, why we love movies, why we watch movies. We're chasing a movie like this where we can watch it and just mm-hmm. Feel like there's magic happening. Not like you don't even have to. You don't have to love every movie that you. When you can acknowledge that there's magic happening without needing to it to be your favorite movie. You know, like exactly. you can't watch Star Wars and say that it's not a magical movie. You don't have to like it, though. You know, like you don't have to like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I don't know why you wouldn't like it, but you don't have to like it to acknowledge that there's something special at play here that like no other movie has really even done since this movie.
You know,
in this unique way.
You know, a friend pointed out to me that as the movie goes on, Gene Wilder's hair gets crazier and crazier. Like, it's true. You actually watch it. It's true. Like, it actually does. And I've only seen one other movie where that happens. And that was in the Farrelly Brothers movie, Kingpin, with Bill Murray. If you watch that, as the movie progresses, his hair gets crazier and crazier until at one point, actually, his hair actually falls off his head. Like,
that's good.
Yeah, it's the continuity people must have had a rough time.
It makes you, or it makes you wonder if they filmed it in sequence even. Like,
they might have been.
The factory stuff. They might, well, because they had fewer actors. So it's like, well, if we don't need, like why would the guy who played Augustus Gloop be there the rest of the filming if he was only needed for that first two scenes?
Exactly. Like, you're in that big factory with all those lights, you know, sweat. I heard must have been hell to be an Oompa Loompa and all that makeup, having to do that choreography. And you don't even speak English. Those guys were all in German. Like, they were just lip syncing badly. I hate to say, if you watch the musical numbers, it's a lot of fun. Like, it's a little mismatched, but it's fun mismatched. It's a lot of fun. It's so creative. It's so much fun.
It's so fun, yeah.
Even with the Mein Kampf font in one of the Oompa Loompa songs. Which song is it?
That's wild.
You'll have to look. So,
yeah.
But I think we've this is not an everlasting gobstopper. We can't be sucking on this all day long. And I think sadly we can't be sucking on this movie all day long. Yeah, there's some innuendo right there. But with that, I think any final thoughts about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
I don't think so. I just I love this movie. It honestly gets better every time I watch it. I watch it. My son loves it. Both my kids like it. And you know, we watch it a lot. And every time I watch it, you notice things. I like movies where you can notice new things every time you watch it, like Toy Story or Star Wars even like Wizard of Oz. Like, you can notice different parts of the world. Whereas the Tim Burton movie, you don't notice really anything new the more you watch it, I don't think. But I'm not going to watch it more to find out.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, like, if nothing else, the 2005 version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory helps confirm why you like the 1970 version of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory so much.
Exactly, yeah.
It does its job. And speaking of its job, I think we've done our job. And with that, I just want to thank everybody. You've been listening to the Pop Czar Podcast, a.k.a. Movie Time. That's an exclamation mark because it's exciting. The Movie Time Podcast from Pop Czar. We have been talking about 1971's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and to a much, 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 much lesser extent, 2005's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But mostly Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
The better movie. The Scrumdiddlyumptious movie. You can't even say this stuff with a straight face. Can you say it? Scrumdiddlyumptious.
Scrumdiddlyumptious.
God, that and supercalifragilistic. Like, someone's getting candy of the brain.
You gotta be British to say it, I think.
You do have to be British. It helps. I think it's the teeth. The 1970s British teeth. I'm sorry, British people, but in the 70s, you needed cavity to help. But with that, I want to thank everybody. My very, very special co-host, Mr. Ethan Brem. Ethan, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Yep, and we will see everybody next time. Bye-bye.
Oompa-loompa-dee-doo. I've got a perfect puzzle for you. Oompa-loompa-loompa-dee-dee. If you are wise, you'll listen to me.
What do you get when you guzzle down sweets?
Eating as much as an elephant eats.
What are you at getting terribly fat?
What do you think will come of that?
I don't like the look of it.
Oompa, loompa, doompa-dee-da. If you're not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too.
Thanks for listening to the Pop Czar Podcast. Remember to like, follow, share, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app or service.